Good afternoon. I would like to call the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development to order.
Well, three guys will stand up, right?
Only you, Jeff.
Some housekeeping business to take care of first. I'd like to open up a work session and public hearing on House Bill 2095. Administrator Donovan, can you give us a summary?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2095 aligns the definition of former foster child with the federal standards, mostly for purposes of higher education grants, tuition waivers, and scholarships. It declares an emergency. It is effective on passage. The committee heard this bill originally a week ago. There is a -1 amendment proposed that would remove a 3-year time period requirement from the existing measure. This has to do with certification capability that the Department of Human Services cannot actually achieve, and so the amended language would not require a 3-year window, but would leave all other parts of the measure operative.
Right, and we talked about, we did not have the fiscal papers for the amendment in that day, so.
Yes, sir.
Senator Cruz?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine.
All right, we're in, is there anybody signed up to testify on this, because it's a public hearing, too? If not, we're in a work session. Senator Knoll.
All right, amazing Chair Haas. I move to adopt -1 amendments, dated April 22nd, 2013.
Senator Knoll moves to adopt the -1 amendments, dated April 22nd, 2013. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none.
Chair, Chair Haas, I move House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knoop moves House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2095 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. We are down to Senator Beyer. Would you like to carry this bill, sir?
Certainly.
Okay. I will close that work session and public hearing, and I will open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2033. Richard?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2033 eliminates the loan of university funds by the Department of State Lands. This deals with two archaic statutes that exist that have to do with about $427,000 worth of accounts currently in the control of the state treasurer, but with responsibilities belonging to the Department of State Lands. There's a -1 amendment proposed, and the -1 amendment would replace the measure, and rather than remove the responsibilities of the Department of Lands, it would abolish the accounts and return the funds in those accounts to the universities as is appropriate.
Mr. Kenton is here today. You might remember this passed the House, and we all asked, well, what happens to the money? And the answer was, it just sits there. And so we came up with this amendment. And
so you made it better.
Yeah, so welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Oregon University System. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2033 and the -1 amendments. And I want to thank you very much for making them, especially the chair, for your personal interest in this. It will allow us to maximize the returns of these monies, which both University of Oregon and Oregon State University plan to use for student scholarships. So it's very important. In looking through the amendment, we're fine with it as written. There is a something that I thought I would point out. In 1926, the federal law governing land grant funds was amended to preclude their investment in equities. It's interesting that happened, you know, 6 years before the Great Depression, but a very smart move probably at that time. So what this amendment will allow us to do is to invest the Oregon State University portion of these monies in long-term investments, but they'll have to be bonds or T-notes, which presently in our treasury, my people are telling me, will return approximately 300 basis points. The other portion of the funds for University of Oregon, because they don't follow that same Land Grant or REAL Act restriction, will be able to be pooled in our endowment fund, where we presently invest in equities and currently have a spend rate of 4% per annum. So in both cases, the funds currently are making about 54 basis points in the state treasurer's float pool. In both cases, it'll be 6 times the return for the OSU portion, 8 times for the UVO portion. And for that, we thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just doing our duty, sir. Thank you, Jay. Any questions?
I'm just wondering if we ought to do a further amendment to free up Oregon State as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that Oregon State is encumbered by federal law, I think going back to the 1861.
Right? So there's really nothing we can do?
Yeah.
Chair House, Senator Cruz, yeah, Oregon State University's attorney looked into it, and
okay.
she agreed with our interpretation that they are encumbered by federal law and they're restricted from being invested in equities.
Okay. But
we did everything we could to try to get that maximum return.
Senator Knoll.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify intent as it relates to OSU. Did you mean OSU or OSU Cascades? The money goes back to
Chairman House, Senator Canope, it's OSU kind of writ large, and it would be up to the administration of the university to determine where the funds would be utilized for the benefit of. But they're both Oregon State University.
Of course.
It's a good question.
Are you talking about Ben Westland University? Is that?
Well, you know, it's got several names.
Okay, and originally this bill was brought to let the Department of Lands out from under it, and I assume you're okay with this amendment, and if you care to testify on this, that'd be great, but if you're okay, you're okay. So, Senator Cruz, you're okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. If it's what we can do, it's what we can do.
Yes. Well, anytime we can return some money and raise the earnings rate.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're in a work session.
Chair House, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2033 dated April 24th, 2013.
Senator Knoop moves to Dash 1 amendments on House Bill 2033, dated April 24th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Hess, I move House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knoop moves House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2033 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. We are up to Senator Roblin.
I would be honored.
Carry this. Okay. Those two bills out of the way, closing the work session and public hearings. And then we move to our charter school day as we try to put themes to every one of our education committee hearings. And we have some legislators on deck to speak to these, and I see the esteemed Representative Doherty. Why don't we hold a public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 3093, and could you give us a quick summary and call up Representative Doherty?
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3093 deals with charter schools and allows the sponsor of charter schools to terminate the charter of a public school for failure of the school to have an audit prepared or for failure to forward that audit information. That audit is required under current law. It requires the school district sponsoring charter schools to include information in the annual audit to the Oregon Department of Education as part of an audit report for the school district. It allows the sponsor to terminate the charter for failure to maintain a sound financial system and to develop a plan to correct deficiencies with the sponsor. And it requires the school district board to consider prior history of applicant in operating a public charter school under this review process when they are considering the proposal for the charter school.
Thank you, Representative. Yeah. You could set the stage. Tell us the problem you're
addressing.
Set the stage. Tell us the problem you're addressing.
I will do that. I will set the stage, then I have to go back to my other committee meeting, and the Department of Ed will take over. But good afternoon, Chair Hass and members of this committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Doherty. I am the state representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3093. In the charter school world, there have been recently some bad actors who were given a black eye to an otherwise honest and law-abiding community. A specific example that comes to mind is that of All Prep Charter Schools, and that will be talked about in just the next testifier. All Prep was basically running a scam, fleecing districts, and with it, taxpaying parents for millions. Had the Oregon Department of Education had a more robust way of ensuring that charter schools follow the letter of the law, this may not have happened. House Bill 3093 adds the enforcement provision to the existing requirement that public charter schools conduct yearly financial audits. If a school does not prepare its audits, its sponsor may revoke the charter. If a school exhibits a history of unsound financial management, a sponsor may also revoke their charter. Furthermore, when evaluating a proposal for a public charter school, sponsors may take into account the prior history of that applicant has in generating a and operating a charter school. This will help ensure that the bad actors don't make it into the system in the first place. I realize that sometimes there are situations where charter schools are having financial difficulties while also doing very well on the education front. So this is why one section of the bill creates a new process that would allow for a charter school and the school district to negotiate a process of a period of receivership in order to settle the financial issues. And this would be completely voluntary on both parties. So this bill is simply designed to ensure that financial accountability with public money and will put no additional burdens on a well-managed charter school. So I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Representative, can you tell me what the concern was with the, it looked like it got quite a few no votes on the floor. Mm-hmm. Was there something specific that people were pointing out?
Yes, there is. In fact, the Department of Ed, Cindy from the Department of Ed, who's their legal counsel, will talk specifically about the All Prep Charter School and the amount of money that was misappropriated, I guess you can say, but she'll go into more to the legal aspects of that.
So do we know of charter schools that aren't doing their audits? Because I know that there are charter schools that have a hard time getting their audits done because right. Sometimes they're the last of the group to get them because they're small.
And sometimes they're a little later. But again, so, Cindy's got all of the information that deals with has and who hasn't and so on.
Because my goal is I want to do exactly what you said at the end. I don't want to punish the people who are trying to do the right thing, even if they are a little late or whatever. And I would love to hear that an audit would have helped us stop All Prep. I'm waiting to hear that from you, Cindy, because I'm not sure that it would. But when all that was happening, we were all here. I'm not sure it gets at that problem. But if there are others that are having some financial difficulties and whatever, I would like to hear that there's a problem before I try to fix it.
And I know Cindy's going to bring up more information, but when the bill was crafted, it was to not punish the charter schools and the players that are doing the right job and doing what they should be doing with public money. And so that's where also, you know, sometimes if an audit's been done but it's late, there are provisions for that, or if they're in the process of an audit, there are provisions for that, or if there are other things that they need to work with the school district, which is the charter sponsor, they can also go through and do that. So that was purposely put into the legislation.
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, Cindy Hunt, Department of Education, but in direct response to your question, Senator Roblin, about how many charter schools haven't turned in their audits, I think this bill was in front of House Ed about 3 weeks ago, and I checked with our folks to see how many charter schools had not turned in their audits from the 2011-12 fiscal year. Those audits would have been due on December 31st, and at that time, 57 charter schools had not turned in their audit, 67 had. Now, that's contrasted to school districts where only two at that time had not turned in their audits, the rest had. And as contrasted to ESDs, which you passed a law 2 years ago that's very similar to this in its enforcement against ESDs, all ESDs had turned in their audits at that point. So that's in direct response to your question.
You got a yay.
Well, it's because ESDs are good.
That's first.
Okay. Cindy, a couple questions, Ms. Chair. Since then, how many of those charter schools have turned in their audits, or do you know? I mean, they didn't meet the deadline. How many have turned them in and they've just been late?
Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, like I said, 3 weeks ago, 57 had not turned audits to the Department of Education.
Okay. Or due December 1st.
Okay, good.
Meaning that, yeah, they were about 4 months late at that point.
Okay. My question is, we have public schools that are in financial difficulty. What's the difference here? I mean, is it just a bad financial plan? I mean, you know, my local school district is closing down a grade school. They're in financial difficulty. So I'm trying to, is there a separation here?
Well, I'm not quite sure if we can answer exactly for a charter school as to why they wouldn't. But I think, you know, if there's, I mean, a part of it is there's no enforcement right now. And with the enforcement for the sponsor of the charter or a K-12 school, the punishment is you don't receive state funds if you don't have, you know, follow the rules. And there is no enforcement procedure from what I understand right now with the charters not complying with the audit procedures with public money.
Yeah, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, that's exactly right. So with the school districts and the ESDs, if they don't turn in their audits, what we do is we notify them you don't have in your audits, and then we start withholding state school fund dollars.
Okay.
And my recollection is the first payment we generally start withholding on is right around in March. And that generally goes on only a month or two, honestly, before they turn in their audits. So with the charter schools, we don't have that same enforcement mechanism right now, and we believe that does contribute to charter schools not turning in their audits. In answer to your question about, you know, would this have prevented all prep or something like that, I am not going to promise that this would have prevented all prep. There's no way I would do that. But what I will say is that if the school districts who are sponsoring those schools, and if we had seen the audits, it would have been a first red flag, a first warning system, you know, because when the DOJ started investigating the all-prep schools, none of them had turned in their audits. And then when we did start getting them, we noticed there were red flags in them. So that's one of the reasons this bill was introduced.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm looking at is the language, failure to maintain a sound financial system. And my question there is, you can have a quote-unquote sound financial system, and if you don't have enough money, it's no longer sound. And that would apply to charter schools and public schools as well. I'm wondering if that is a reason for failure. I mean, are you seeing what I'm getting at here? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I've got a good plan, but we don't give you enough money, and you fail because of that. Is that your fault, or... You see what I'm getting at? I'm just trying to see if the rules are applying kind of across the board. And I know that's...
Well, I think part of it is maybe kind of answer your question, is that whether you're a public charter or whether you're a public school, and let's face it, they've been under financial duress for a long time. They still have the obligation with public funds to go through and do an audit. So even though, you know, you cannot have much money and still have very sound financial practices. And I think that's what we're looking for in an audit, is that, you know, you could have had to cut programs and done this and this, but as long as you still have the sound financial practices, which, you know, you do, and audits go through and point out, well, you're good in this, but you under, you know, the auditing practices of what you need to do this and this better. So I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but you can have a sound financial practices without necessarily having strong financial stability.
Okay.
Yeah. Senator Byer?
Well, the question is, with this bill, will it put it in the position of requiring an independent audit, as is required of all school districts now? And will that have to be filed with the Secretary of State's office?
Chair Haas, Senator Byer, right now charter schools are required to complete annual audits, and they are required to submit those to their sponsors. It's just that there is not the enforcement mechanisms in place. For example, the Department of Ed doesn't have the direct authority to withhold state school fund dollars if they do not turn them in to us. So that's the difference. And the annual audit requirement was something that was put into the law in 1999. It's been there since the beginning. That's not a new, you know, requirement.
So they only have to provide them to the sponsor. So it's not the same as, are those then incorporated in the sponsor's audit or audit report to the Secretary of State that's required?
Chair Haas, Senator Beyer, in case I misled, they also do send them to us now. That's why we've received 67 of them. But my understanding is that with some of them, they are incorporated into the school district's audit as well. And what I mean by that is that we have some districts that only have one school, so they're more tied to their charter schools. But it kind of depends, and some are more independent and then are sent in.
Am I incorrect? I thought all of the school districts had to file with Secretary of State's Audits Division annually an independent audit.
Chair Haas, Senator Beyer, I think that is true. What I'm not sure is if the charter school audit is part of that.
If they aren't, they should be.
It surprises me that this enforcement dynamic, it doesn't exist for public charter schools, but exists for public schools.
You know, Chair Haas, it was something that, I mean, it wasn't until the all prep mess, you know, when we really started diving into it and we went, okay, wait a minute, we didn't get these audits. Why is that? And then we started looking at other charter schools and we realized that a number of them were not turning in their audits. And we started looking at it and we had discovered the ESDs were kind of similar 2 years ago and that bill had gone through. And it wasn't until, unfortunately, you had this situation that we went, oh, okay, we don't have that kind of enforcement mechanism. School districts, you know, the theory behind charter schools originally was that school districts, their sponsors, would hold them accountable. And I can tell you that the State Board of Education sponsors four state schools. All four of those have turned in their audits. We, you know, make it a priority for them, I'll put it that way. So, you know, but if the school districts don't have as much of, you know, an enforcement mechanism, if it's not, you know, highlighted as much that they could terminate the charter school, or then the enforcement mechanism that's in the bill is separate for us specifically, so we're not going through the school district to terminate the school. Mm-hmm. But the all prep situation, the big thing that I think a lot of people are shocked at is that the $20 million that's part of the racketeering suit, that was money that they fraudulently obtained in about a period of 2 years. It wasn't a long period of time. So this was not something that went on for a long time that school districts, you know, were turning the other cheek or anything like that. It was 2 years, roughly.
Was there a prosecution?
Chair Haas, Senator Beyer, I've attached an article. The Oregon Department of Justice filed a racketeering suit against the Ed Choices and Tim King and Norm Donahue under Oregon's racketeering law. And specifically what they're alleging is that through this enterprise that they violated, they did this pattern of racketeering that, you know, included falsifying business records, two violations of unsworn falsifications, two violations of wire fraud, and money laundering. They did that in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney General and the Federal Inspector General, because there's also federal funds in place. And so that suit is currently pending, and our Oregon Department of Justice is pursuing that with zeal under their law enforcement arm.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just making sure that, so there will be a couple tools for a sponsoring district. One, the state would withhold money, and therefore it would not be passed in on to the school, to the charter school. The other is that they can terminate them. Is there a, as I was reading, I couldn't, can you do either one or take your pick, or do you have an opportunity, do they have an opportunity to fix something if they've made an error?
Yeah, Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, let me kind of break those apart. So under the first one in the termination piece, so under charter school law, there's two ways basically now of terminating a school. One's for health and safety, and that's a 10-day notice. Health and safety of children, that's not what we're talking about here. Under this one, though, the sponsor gives a 60-day notice to the school, and so they would notify the school, and presumably they would say, you know, we propose to terminate you on this date because you have not turned in your audit. And then the school would have, like I said, a 60-day notice. What we find is that often what happens is in other reasons for termination now, often the school rectifies the situation in that 60 days and then they go on operating. You know, that's the ideal situation. Then if the school didn't, under charter school law, they have a hearing And they can appeal the sponsor's decision to the State Board of Education and to the courts and so forth. Now, as far as the withholding of state school fund dollars, that would be the Department of Ed making that decision. So for, and I would anticipate we would do it in a similar manner to how we do with school districts. So those two school districts I talked about that didn't turn in their audits, we provided notice to them that we're going to withhold state school fund dollars, and now we are doing that every month until they turn it in, and then when they turn in their audits, they get their money. So, you know, because we don't, I mean, they're still owed the money. But obviously, for most schools and districts, I would say, if you withhold state school fund dollars, there's only a limited amount of time that they'll be able to operate under that kind of situation.
So in that case, you would, if they were getting 80% or 90%, depending on what it was, you'd still send the school district their amount?
I believe we would withhold from the charter school. Well, actually, I take that back. We would withhold from the school district the entire
whole
amount.
Right.
Yeah.
So the school, the regular school would also not be getting their money. So it would be an incentive to make sure that they got the audits in as well.
Yeah. And Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, right now, when we, on occasion, we get a complaint about a charter school or something, when we notify the charter school that we've received a complaint that they're violating the law or something, we always copy the sponsor district. So I'd anticipate with this, we would be copying, you know, the sponsor district would also be in the loop and also know that this was going on. They should know anyway that their charter school hadn't turned in their audit, but if they didn't for some reason, they would get the notice from us as well.
Well, especially if they're going to lose money too. It would be good for them to know that
exactly
it's happening. Okay.
Yeah.
And if I could real quick, because I have to get back to committee, is that, you know, for this is, I mean, they're almost half of the charter schools have not turned in the audits, but there are an awful lot of charter schools that out there that do that every year. They are good purveyors of public funds. They are good educators and this kind of thing. It's just the idea to have some sort of an enforcement for quite a few of them that are not doing, to me, a due diligence on public money. And sometimes we forget it is public. It's our taxpayers' money. And so that's the reason for the bill. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you very much.
Let's call up Karen Hikas.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas, members of the committee. My name is Karen Hikas, and I am with the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which represents charter schools. The majority of the charter schools in this state are members of our organization. And I would like to speak to House Bill 3093 and also to the Dash 2 amendments. I think you have a pretty clear idea about what this bill would do at this point of the conversation, although I will say that districts that don't turn their audits in on time don't get shut down. They might have state school funds withheld. They might be put on notice that, hey, you're late, you need to submit it. But to terminate a school for not submitting their audit on time seems a little extreme for us. We absolutely, by the way, support fiscal accountability. We actually do full-day workshops on sound financial management systems and how to, you know, provide technical assistance to charter schools on how to make sure that they are implementing and maintaining sound financial management systems. That said, there's no definition of sound financial management system anywhere, in statute, in rule, anywhere, even in any district policy that I've seen. So to kind of leave that up to the subjective interpretation of all the districts that sponsor charters seems to put charters in a very vulnerable position, a more vulnerable position. Right now the law says that if a charter does not maintain a sound system for 2 years or more, they can be terminated. The bill would change the law to say basically at any point in time a charter doesn't have a sound financial management system in the eyes of the district that sponsors it, they can be terminated. And even though they get a 60-day notice, it's in the middle of the school year and they go into survival mode instead of the mode of educating children. That's not an ideal scenario. At the very least, we think we need to define sound financial management system in the law. because there's so much to it. There's so much to having a sound financial management system. The piece about the audit, Senator Roblin touched on this, that, you know, charter schools originally were required to submit a municipal audit according to municipal audit law, and they've always been required to do that. Even though they're not municipalities, it's always been a little bit of an awkward fit. So they're not audits like other 501c3s receive, which charters are 501c3s. They're municipal audits, and there's a limited number of audit firms in our state that do these audits, and they are working with the big municipalities in their areas. And charter schools are typically on the very bottom of their list. And over the years, I've worked with charters for 10 years, and I've heard complaints constantly throughout that time about the audit firms getting the audits late to the charters. The charter gives their auditor all the information they need. They close out their fiscal books June 30, just like everybody else, and they give their info to their audit firm. Their audit firm is often late getting it to them. If we have 57 charters that haven't turned in their audits, I would be curious how many have their audits and haven't submitted them. There probably are some. How many haven't received their audits back from their audit firms? My guess would be the majority would fall into that category. And if we have 57 who haven't submitted their audits, and this law were in effect, we could shut down 57 schools right now. That would disrupt a lot of kids' education. And I don't think that that is going to solve a problem. I think that's going to create more problems. So what we would like to see is the ability for a district to put a charter on a plan of assistance if their audit is late. And by the way, the bill does not say we're giving you a 60-day termination notice, and if you turn in your audit, we'll take that back. The bill does not say that. The bill says the school can be terminated for failure to turn in its audit on time, period. And it does have a provision for if a charter is being terminated for sound financial management systems, you can have 60 days, and you might put them on a plan of assistance to fix that. But even if a charter turns its audit in, this bill does not say that the district would have to redact its termination. So that's a little concerning as well. The fact is they were late. Even if they turn it in eventually, they're still late. They still, you know, violated that term of their contract. They still violated the law. So does that mean they should still be terminated? I don't know. I would say no. So we would love to see the opportunity for a plan of assistance and also leave that two-year failure to maintain sound financial management systems in statute. So that's what the Dash 2s do. I think that's all I have, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. It seems like to me that the rule should be applied evenly, that if public schools don't follow the rules and their payments are withheld, then that should be the same rule for our charter schools.
I think that would be fine. I think that's better than shutting them down. I mean, districts don't get shut down if they don't turn in their audits, right?
And as we heard in the testimony, that does tend to get their attention when the school payments don't come. So,
sure.
Senator Roblin?
I agree. No, I'm in the same, trying to figure out the same thing.
Senator, no? No?
I generally agree with that, but also, you know, the school districts also get 100% of their EDMW, too, which a charter school doesn't. And so they're having to take, obviously, precious money that's trying to be directed at kids to do an audit. Now, that's not to suggest that they shouldn't receive an audit, but I think, you know, I think a couple issues have been brought up. You know, why not a 501c3 audit, which is what they are, versus a municipal audit? I think we ought to look at that to see if that's reasonable or not. And whether or not there's a better mechanism to help the charter schools out that aren't getting the audits in, because I think we all want to protect public funds and protect the education of these kids. But I don't think we want to do it by putting the schools in jeopardy or the kids' education in jeopardy just because, you know, somebody didn't get an audit in on time. You know, if you don't pay your taxes, they don't revoke your citizenship. So, at least not right away. So,
well, you end up going to jail.
I don't know. I pay my taxes, so I don't know. But I just think there's a little more work that could be done on this bill.
Yeah. Senator Beyer?
Well, I'll just note that the bill doesn't say will be terminated. It says may. And I would assume, as they usually do, you're probably common sense. The idea would be to get on a plan of assistance, but it's to provide that hammer that I think makes sense to do that. Certainly, you want to make sure the department has, when they have the instance like the one they talked to, that they have the ability to take the the course to protect public money that we would expect them to, which may be terminate immediately.
Senator Cruz?
Does the school district, is there audit a municipal audit?
There's not that much difference.
It has to do with assets, between some other kinds of things that they have to deal with.
They're all compliant.
We should be able to compare apples and apples, I guess. But, you know, if a 501c3 audit is not a whole lot different, and I don't know the answer to that, but.
It's general accounting board standards are about the same.
Okay.
Why don't we do this with respect to that question within this bill? Join a little work group, work with some of the key players here, and maybe modify an amendment that might be considered
two different audits.
Okay.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you.
Thanks.
No.
The school district doesn't. They should do it.
But I think the school district.
Yeah, she's here.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2875. Richard could give us a summary, and Representative Parrish is here. She could come forward.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2875 provides that expiring charters remain in effect for public charter schools until a new charter is negotiated following the approval of the renewal of the charter. It declares an emergency effective on passage and was unanimous off of the House floor.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, State Representative from House District 37, and your able-bodied administrator pretty much said exactly what this bill does. Notwithstanding the time period specified in the charter, an expiring charter shall remain in effect until the new charter is negotiated. And essentially, what we're trying to get at there is that if the charter, the sponsor and the charter have not come to terms, that the children should not be misplaced, or the charter shouldn't stop being in existence while the grown-ups in the room are just trying to settle out the details of a new charter. We want to make sure that the kids have the continuity. So that's all that this bill is asking for. It's a pretty simple, easy fix. And, you know, sometimes charter, we had a companion bill to this, did not move out of education. But, you know, sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes the charter relationship between the sponsor and the charter school is not necessarily a friendly relationship for whatever reason. That does happen. In fact, the other bill was really about how do you get to divorce your sponsor and find a new one was the other bill. So at least while somebody is going through that process, the charter and the sponsor are going through that process, that we don't want to see kids get bounced around and not have the school function and people lose their jobs. And because they can't come to an agreement on a charter, we want to give them more time to do that, but keep school moving. That's it. Simple bill.
Was there a case or a problem?
You know, there have been some problems. I think this happened down one of the charter schools down in I don't want to name names because I just want to make sure that I've got the right group, but one of the ones in kind of a rural community had this issue happen, I believe. I want to say it was Kings Valley, but not 100% sure.
Senator Byer.
Well, I mean, what's the incentive? If I assume that their charter renewal would almost happen as just a course of business, unless there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a problem, what's the incentive for resolving the problem?
What's the incentive for resolving the problem?
Yeah, if they continue under the existing charter without any leverage to the contract. I mean, you have a contract and the contractor relationship, and if you're contracting for service and you believe it's not being provided,
I mean, you could say the same with bus drivers and everybody else. They're, you know, I said you could say the same with bus drivers and other public contracts that, you know, where they haven't reached negotiations, but TriMet doesn't stop the bus service. The goal is that you don't want to hurt the people who need the service, but you want to make sure that both people can continue to come to the table and have the conversation. So in terms of is there a finite time or, you know, an end time, that's not in this. Sometimes, I mean, TriMet's gone without a contract, for example, for a couple years, and the buses still run. Well, so,
Representative, in your scenario, if you're talking about a labor dispute, the aggrieved party would be the bus drivers, and their remedy to that is they can go on strike and stop the bus company. In this situation, you don't have that.
Actually, I don't think TriMet bus drivers can strike.
But
they certainly can.
But neither here nor there. The aggrieved party here is not the adults in the room. It's the children. I mean, this is the goal is to make sure those kids are not being displaced.
Senator Robler?
But I think she was mentioning more if it was Laidlaw was providing your bus service, and the contract between the district and Laidlaw was not revised. Does Laidlaw just keep providing it, or do they just have to go away? What happens there? I don't know the answer to that question. Right. Not with the employees, but with the company that was providing the bus service. At some point, if they don't get a new contract, apparently they just pull the buses and go away. Yeah. That's their remedy. So I understand your concerns that there's no reason to try to get to a new contract if it just stays in place. But
I think we're talking basically in a situation where the sponsor has approved the renewal and you're in negotiations. Is that correct? And this this expands the time of negotiation. There's already been an approval. Okay.
Yeah, they've been approved once. Yeah. This is a renewal.
Yeah. I mean, so the initial phase has already happened. This is negotiation after the approval of the continuation.
Well, if I may, Senator, issue there, if there wasn't an issue,
there wouldn't be
a problem. The renewal would be signed. You're talking about a situation where there's obviously a disagreement.
But it's also once the sponsor has approved and then they're negotiating, so the approval has happened. So I'm assuming if at some point in time the approval disappeared, it disappears. I think this is just extending the time frame for negotiations on something that's approved. And I mean, phase one has happened and this is.
Why don't we bring up Karin Hikes from the Charter Schools Association, which is not what it's called, but that's what it is.
Charter School Association.
Unless I'm missing something here.
No, you're
thank you, Senator Haas. Karin Hikes, you're exactly right. The charter renewal process is a little funky, as is the upfront process. Each are two steps. So a new charter submits an application. The district says, yes, we will approve your application. We will authorize you to operate your charter school. And the next step is the district and the charter negotiate a contract, which may or may not be identical to the proposal that was submitted because those terms can change. So it's kind of like a betrothal marriage analogy. On renewal, it's really similar. The board decides whether or not to renew the contract, but it's not merely a contract extension. They essentially agree to renew the relationship. We will continue to sponsor you as a charter school, and then they negotiate a contract. So the decision has already been made to renew, as Senator Cruz said, and the decision's based on their past performance, et cetera. The negotiation can get a little dicey because one party might want terms the other party doesn't want. How many students they serve, how many grades, which grade levels they serve, those sorts of details. And even though they're supposed to be negotiated, the reality is the district is in the power position with the charter school. They always are. And that's just the way it is set up. And so what this bill does is it says you've agreed to renew the charter. You don't have a new contract yet. Until you have a new contract, your previous contract terms apply and stay in effect. And we honestly initially were a little ambivalent on this bill. We thought, well, I don't know if it's solving a problem or not. But then I started to think back to situations over the years where a district will renew a charter contract. They'll say, we'll renew you. But if you don't agree to these terms, you're actually not going to exist next year. If you don't agree to our enrollment cap or the grades we say you're going to serve or whatever other terms, then you're gone. So the charters feel pressure, and they have pressure to either accept terms that aren't acceptable to them or to close their doors. And so this creates a longer time frame to mutually agree to new terms. And the school stays open and the kids' education is not disrupted. As Representative Parrish said, some relationships between charters and districts are not friendly. Many are. We need to protect those that might be in vulnerable positions already. So we support the bill.
Further questions? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to call close the public hearing on 2875, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2150. It, too, deals with charter schools. Part of our theme continues. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2150A modifies the contents of and process for proposal to establish a public charter school. It modifies the process for renewal of a public charter school and the termination of a charter for a public charter school. It clarifies the list of laws that apply to public charter schools. There are two amendments for this measure. One is the dash fives, which loosens the requirements of board composition for charter schools, where the charter school is the only local school. This concerns mainly small regional charter schools where there's a concern about the actual number of board members and whether or not a small school could fulfill those requirements. There's a second amendment that the dash twos from the House side that were only recently received by the committee, and one of the testifiers will speak to, I imagine.
Okay, Cindy Hunt and Lori Wimmer.
Yes, I guess Jan McCone said.
And Jan McCone.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. We were one of the participants in a 10-year charter task force review committee that was convened by the Oregon School Boards Association. And you'll hear from them in a minute, too. The group was a large one. It included legislators from both chambers. It included folks who sponsor or serve on boards of charter schools, as well as the Education Alphabet Soup and a number of other players. The idea was, and we met for a very long time and put a lot of work into it, and the Department of Ed was very helpful to us as well, is to look at the charter school law 10 years after it had first been enacted by the 1999 legislature and see whether or not it was kept up to date, whether or not there were problems that could be solved from everybody's perspective. We had a much longer list than what ended up in the original bill that was introduced in 2011, and that bill was, in effect, the consensus elements from all of that work of the 10-year review committee. That bill did very well on the Senate side and stalled out on the House side, sadly, and so we're back in 2013 with a version that also incorporates the changes to charter school law that were made subsequent to the development of that charter review process. And we're here in support of the bill that's before you today. We also support the amendment brought by the Oregon School Boards Association to clarify the single school district charter board only needs to be the one board. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jan to talk about the substance of the bill.
That was a dash one amendment we were speaking to.
Yes. Dash, is it five now?
A5.
A5,
okay. Thanks. Go ahead, Jan.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, Jan McComb, Cindy Hunt, stepping in. She had to leave the committee. You might recall that Cindy was legislative counsel back in 1999, and she was the one who drafted the charter school bill originally. And I was staffing on the Senate side, and I think we had like 53 sets of amendments, so we sort of bonded over that. I was trying to color code all the and hand engross all the amendments, and I still
those
wake up.
Those were the fun times, weren't they?
Good times. So Cindy participated in this work group with everyone and looking at the charter school bill law. It's now 14 years old. And I think we always knew that there were going to be bumps in the road, and we were going to revisit it. And we actually thought we would revisit it much sooner than we are. And so OSBA put together this work group with all the stakeholders, and they had various discussions and arguments. And what came out of that was a consensus bill that this committee's already voted on last session. It was before you and passed out over to the House where it got bogged down. Richard's already explained what the bill does, so I don't need to take up any more of your time, but we think it's a good bill, and we've looked over the amendments. They seem to be fine.
Okay. Questions on the bill or the dash five?
Does it leave in audits or take them out? No, I'm just kidding.
That was a good bill, too.
Okay.
I sat with these people a long time on this.
Yes.
Yes. So the Senate Education Committee of 2011 spent a long time on this bill.
Absolutely before that.
I got a question.
Senator Canope.
Does 2150 add public contracting to public charter schools?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, our understanding was public contracting was always a part of the law. One of the things about the bill is that we felt that a lot of charter schools did not understand all the laws to which they were held accountable already. So our goal was just to put that more front and center by putting it in the bill, by making it clear that these are all the laws charter schools must comply with. And that's been the case since 1999. I understand, though, that a lot of charter schools are unaware of several of the provisions, that being one of them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cope, there's an opinion the committee received earlier today about that, and the opinion from the Office of Legislative Counsel indicates that public charter schools are subject to those laws, whether or not this bill is enacted.
That's not necessarily binding on them, but it's an opinion.
It is an opinion.
All right, and you're not, you two were not speaking to the Dash 2s.
I understand you've questioned
okay.
opinions before.
Thank you. Well, let's bring up Lori Satinspiel and Karen Hikes again.
Nice to keep them all in one day.
Yep. True. Lori Satinspiel, Chair for the Record, Oregon School Boards Association. Here in support of the bill, the process. Thank you. And speaking to the Dash 5s, I got a call from Ione Charter School. We don't have enough people in our town to go and have two separate boards with all of these people. So they asked for an amendment that would exempt them. And we did also on the other side in the House audits. The charter and the school district have to provide audits in a single school district or a charter district. There's only one entity, so there's basically one set of books. So we amended it that said we only had to do one audit. So that was on the other side. And Mr. Chair and Senator Knope, before you ask me why the vote count was what it was, I think some members think this is an impediment to charter schools, and I don't think we fleshed it out well enough in that House committee and probably a little more due diligence with members to focus on that. Our hope was to streamline the process of the charter developers and the charter school with the amount of new proposals coming forward. And some of those processes were, is the proposal valid? Should we move forward? And it went in this sort of spiral, and we had no out. So they kept going, coming to the board. It was said, no, it's not complete, and it would go back. And it was just a constant cycle. So what we've added some help for that in the process, that we can have the state board or ODE determine if that is a complete proposal. So we're trying to help with the process to make it get more streamlined and in resources. And I think I'm going to leave it at that point. Let Karen speak.
Okay. Senator Haas, members of the committee, Karen Hikes, and yes, I'll echo most of the things that have been said already by the other three on this bill. I was on the group. There was a broad representation on the group, and we did decide up front that, our goal, of course, was to propose legislation. That was our goal. But we decided up front that we would only recommend consensus issues that we could all agree on. So that's why the bill doesn't necessarily include anyone's top priorities for how to amend the charter law, because we all have different priorities, the folks that were represented at that table. But it does include some key, tweaks that we all could reach consensus on. In terms of the charter school perspective, we don't think that this bill is a great help to charters. We also don't think it does great harm to charters, generally speaking. So we support the bill. We are part of the process. I will say, with the exception of the provision on public contracting, which I am getting dozens and dozens of calls from my charter school saying they are completely flipping their lids about the prospect of having to comply with public contracting. Now, if the law has already applied to them, they do not know that. They have not been doing it. There are very few that do. Most charter schools, their central office consists of an administrator, maybe a full-time administrator, or maybe a part-time one because they're also teaching part-time, and probably, if they're lucky, a full-time secretary, maybe a part-time secretary. They do not have
a central office that can implement this whole public contracting RFP process. So it's just not a good fit for them, besides the fact that they do receive about roughly half the per pupil funding compared to traditional district schools. So they don't have the funding or the infrastructure to do it. So our amendment would amend both RS 338 and the public contracting code to make it very clear that charter schools do not have to comply with public contracting. There's already a list of 11 entities in the public contracting code that don't have to comply with it, 11 public entities, including the legislative department, the judicial department, the Oregon Corrections Enterprise, I won't read them all, things I didn't even know existed, like the Travel Information Council, Oregon Innovation Council. Sorry, I have my own. I just got these reading glasses. Getting old. So this would be like the 12th group added to the list of publicly funded entities that don't have to comply with public contracting. So we would support the bill with that amendment. Without that amendment, we can't support the bill because we have charters telling us that this would shut them down or would severely gut them if they had to implement this and pay higher rates for all their services because of complying with it.
Even though we have at least one legal opinion, non-binding though it may be, that says...
Well, that's why we're amending the public contracting code too, which would, in theory, change that interpretation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
The point, I think, was what you just made is whether this bill passes or not in its current form, they're still subject to the public contractors law. So this bill doesn't really change it. It could change that with your amendments.
Correct.
But it doesn't change that.
Correct.
We believe the requirement applies to public charter schools.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can ask.
Senator Beyer?
Why is this an issue? I mean, the public contracting law is not that onerous on small purchases, which I'm assuming most of the public, the kinds of purchases a charter school are making probably don't fall under the law anyway. They're small enough that they...
Isn't there a monetary figure? Isn't there a monetary figure at some level?
Yeah, there is. And the services,
we just changed
that,
one to $10,000.
It's pretty small.
To 5 to 10.
Previously, I think for construction, it might be $50,000.
75.
75,
yeah.
Chair House, members of the committee, I just know that, and I'm not a public contracting code expert by any stretch of the imagination, and I have never run a charter school. I have started many and been on boards, but what I'm hearing from my folks is that this would affect their information technology services, their janitorial services, many of those types of services that they contract out, for instance, with a parent in their school that does it, you know, kind of on the side to help the school, and they don't charge prevailing wage. They don't charge market rate. Most charters, I mean, they don't have facility money, so the capital piece doesn't apply to them for the most part. I think we've had two charters build buildings in the history of the charter law. But a lot of their operational pieces, this would affect.
I can understand the fear of the unknown. That's really what you're talking about. I think if they, I would be surprised if very much of what they're doing falls under it, just because of the limits on professional services and such. I'd be really surprised if it does.
I just have to take their word for it. I appreciate that. But when, you know, they're calling me saying this would affect us in these ways, yeah, it concerns
well,
us.
Well, we will look into this a little bit deeper before okay. we take any action on it.
Thank you.
I'm confident we can find some sort of way to get this bill passed this time. So, thank you both.
Thanks.
Okay. And that ends for now our Charter Schools Day, to be revisited soon.
Yep.
Thanks to Senator Canope and Roblin for doing a small work group to come up with a new amendment on House Bill 3093. And we'll hopefully address that in the next week or so. Thank you. With no other business before us, we are adjourned.